Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, RCVS and European Specialist in Veterinary Anesthesia and Analgesia, Becky Robinson. Thank you, Becky. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi everyone. So today's topic is going to be talking about feline anesthesia and hopefully providing some practical tips for providing safe feline anesthesia. This is just a very quick outline of what I'm planning on covering today. So we'll start with some of the basics, looking at some of the specific factors which can affect patient risk, then looking at some of the feline specifics, and taking some of those specifics into a little bit more detail, including airway management, temperature management, and recognition of acute pain and analgesia in this species. So one of the main responsibilities for an anaesthetist is to reduce the risk and optimize the patient's experience of anaesthesia. Even for the most simplest of cases, anaesthesia of feline patients is often considered more problematic than for the equivalent canine patient. Indeed, we have studies which have shown that the mortality associated with sedating or anaesthetizing cats is actually greater than for dogs. And we can see that for any case, whether that be healthy or sick, the canine mortality under sedation and anaesthesia has been shown to be 0.17%, and for cats, 0.24%. It is hypothesized that some of the reasons for this increased mortality could be due to factors such as the cat is a smaller patient, they can have a greater degree of subclinical comorbidities, for example, cardiac disease, which often cats are very good at hiding. There can be increased difficulties surrounding airway management, including tracheal intubation. And also, cats are likely to have an increased risk of fluid overload simply because they have a smaller blood volume when compared to dogs. There have been some relatively recent guidelines for feline anaesthesia published by the American Association of Feline Practitioners, and these are really comprehensive and provide advice regarding all aspects of feline anaesthesia, and they can be accessed free of charge online. And what I'm going to cover in the following notes or the following talk kind of take some of these from some of these guidelines. I'm not really going to discuss specific anaesthetic protocols. Instead, I'm highlighting some of the general principles associated with feline anaesthesia and the specific differences that they can pose compared with our canine patients. So one of the largest studies investigating veterinary anaesthetic risk, which is known as the Confidential Inquiry into Perioperative Small Animal Fatalities, or CEPSAF for short, identified numerous factors affecting the mortality associated with feline anaesthesia. Some of these factors are inherently associated with patient signalment, over which we can have very little influence. However, others are primarily associated with patient management, and therefore I think it's useful to go through these and have a knowledge of these factors, because we can therefore hopefully avoid inadvertently increasing risk if we can manage these particular factors. What is important to realize is that when you look at these studies, they tend to show us that in general, the drug-related effects are much less important than procedure, patient, and management factors, which in my mind kind of highlights the fact that sometimes, even when presented with a really sick case, we are better off using familiar drugs, regardless of whether there might be an alternative which is considered safer. Because if we're using drugs or protocols which we're not familiar with, then we're not going to be able to recognize necessarily when something is going wrong. So starting off with looking at anaesthetic risk and our ASA status. So a combination of the patient history and physical examination will allow the patient's physical status to be assessed. The American Society of Anesthesiologists, or ASA, devised a scale to rate physical status in humans prior to anaesthesia, but we commonly use a version of this in our veterinary patients. It does have relevance to us, if we can identify what the patient's ASA status is, because there are numerous studies out there which show that this scale does have predictive values, where patients who have an ASA score of more than 3, that is patients who are considered to be sick patients, have a greater risk of perianesthetic complications compared with those with ASA scores of 1 or 2. And if we can identify these patients, then we can allow better preparation and hopefully deal with any potential problems much quicker and more effectively. Going back to that big epidemiological study, SEPSAF, that looked at ASA status, and again, it found there was a predictive value for patient outcome. So the SEPSAF study demonstrated that increasing a feline patient's ASA status by one category, that is either an ASA 1 or 2 patient to an ASA 3, or an ASA 3 patient to an ASA 4 or 5 patient, was associated with a threefold increase in risk of death. Extremes of age may also have an influence on our anaesthetic or sedative protocols. Typically, cats are considered to be neonates when they're less than 4 weeks of age and pediatric when they're less than 12 weeks of age. On the other end of the scale, geriatric patients are sometimes considered to be over 8 years of age, although an alternative and potentially more accurate way to consider a geriatric patient is that once they've reached 75 to 80% of their expected lifespan. At these extremes of age, anatomy and physiology may be altered, either through incomplete development or degeneration of body systems. And again, going back to that big epidemiological study, SEPSAF, this has shown us that an increasing age is associated with an increased odds of death in the feline patient, with cats more than 12 years of age being twice as likely to die as young adults aged between 0.5 to 5 years of age. Extremes of body weight have also been shown to influence the anaesthetic or sedative risk, with cats weighing less than 2 kilos nearly 16 times as likely to die as those weighing between 2 and 6 kilos. Amongst other things, this is likely to be associated with an increased risk of hypothermia and greater challenges associated with monitoring of anaesthesia. The same study demonstrated that cats over 6 kilos were nearly 3 times as likely to die as those weighing between 2 and 6 kilograms. This is probably linked to some extent with body condition score. So we know that obesity, which is defined as a body condition score of greater than 7 out of 9, results in a pro-inflammatory state. And this has been linked with a number of potential anaesthetic problems, including upper respiratory tract obstruction and hypoventilation, tachycardia, hypertension, and left ventricular hypertrophy with diastolic dysfunction. There can also be alterations in drug pharmacokinetics, leading to suggestions of dosing for ideal lean body mass rather than actual mass. Conversely, cachexic animals, that is those with a body condition score of less than 3 out of 9, may develop hypothermia and or hypoglycemia, which can contribute to anaesthetic risk. In terms of procedure urgency, it's been found that an increase in one increment of urgency, that is, for example, from a scheduled procedure to urgent procedure, or from an urgent procedure to an emergency procedure, was associated with a 1.6 increased odds of death in feline patients. Now, it isn't possible to alter the urgency of a procedure. Emergencies often require anaesthesia rapidly after presentation. And while essential diagnostics or surgical treatment should not be delayed, we do need to make sure that there is some attempt at pre-anaesthetic stabilisation prior to performing anaesthesia or sedation. This can include things such as fluid therapy to counteract hypovolemia or electrolyte disturbances, treatment of cardiac arrhythmias, or use of blood products to treat life-threatening anaemia. And this can often be done while things are getting prepared to take the patient for whatever procedure they need to have done. Interestingly, one of the things which came out in the epidemiological study associated with anaesthetic risk in cats was the use of an endotracheal tube. And the use of an endotracheal tube was shown to actually double the risk of anaesthetic death in cats. Now, this may seem counterintuitive given that endotracheal tubes ensure a protected airway, somewhat negating the risk of obstruction and aspiration. However, we all know that cats have a sensitive larynx which is prone to spasm or edema. This idea of using an endotracheal tube and airway management is going to be covered a little bit later on in the talk, so I'm not going to spend too much time on that here, but it is something that is worth being aware of and highlighting. Similarly, something else which might be surprising is the use of fluid therapy. Now, we've already mentioned that feline patients are more likely to suffer fluid overload compared with dogs. And this is partly because cats have a smaller circulating volume and also probably a greater incidence of subclinical cardiac disease. Use of fluid therapy in cats has been shown to result in a fourfold increase in death, most likely due to a combination of their propensity for fluid overload, but also the fact that sometimes we are administering fluids without equipment that have inbuilt safety systems. So, for example, if we don't have syringe drivers or fluid pumps, then it is relatively easy to administer a fluid overload in these patients. However, having said that, fluid therapy should not be withheld from cats which have an absolute or relative fluid deficit. Simply, we need to make sure we administer them carefully and monitor the administration of these fluids. Monitoring of a peripheral pulse and or the use of a pulse oximeter has been shown to reduce the risk of death in cats by 3 to 4 times. One hypothesis for this is that the use of a pulse oximeter is simply acting as an indicator for closer anaesthetic monitoring being performed and therefore problems being picked up sooner. Other forms of monitoring, such as blood pressure monitoring, capnography and electrocardiography, doesn't have the same evidence for its use reducing mortality. However, again, this is probably simply because at the time the study was performed, this sort of monitoring was not commonly used in practice. Despite this, logic does dictate that their use can only aid with physiological monitoring and early detection of problems, and therefore can hopefully help avert problems and minimize the risk of mortality. So moving on now to some aspects regarding handling of cats and their hospitalisation. So we all know that cats are prone to experiencing stress, fear and anxiety within a veterinary environment. And this can often lead to aggressive behaviours which place personnel at risk of injuries. Additionally, such emotions are not conducive for successful and safe anaesthesia. An increase in catecholamines can lead to tachycardia, systemic hypertension, and tachypnea, which may all lead to an increased anaesthetic risk. Therefore, efforts to minimize stress, fear, and anxiety are vital for both reducing circulating catecholamines and improving the individual's experience. The International Society for Feline Medicine, or ISFM, have produced client information sheets and provide advice to veterinary practices with regards to becoming a cat-friendly clinic in order to promote improved care of feline patients. Further information can be found at their website, and it's really useful to have a look at if you're not familiar with this. Proactive actions can be taken before the cat even arrives at the clinic. Clients can be educated on the best way to reduce stress during transportation from the home environment, including acclimatisation to the cat carrier, covering the carrier in blankets, and using familiar bedding with judicious use of commercially available feline pheromones such as Feliway. Some authors recommend administration of gabapentin, a dose of either 50 to 100 milligrams, 2 to 3 hours prior to hospital administration, as this can act as an anxiolytic and decrease negative emotions which can lead to aggressive behaviour. Pre-hospital administration of gabapentin has been shown to improve both owner and veterinarian assessed scores of stress and compliance, although this was associated with temporary side effects, including sedation, ataxia, hypersalivation, and vomiting. Upon arrival to the veterinary clinic, specific measures including separating cats away from predator species such as dogs will aid it with anxiety reduction. Facilities to prevent direct eye contact with other cats and to allow cats to be placed at a height, both in the waiting room and consulting room, is also beneficial. Needless to say, all rooms and cages should be escape-proof. While hospitalised, efforts to ease feline stress levels can include provision of soft bedding and keeping the food and water bowl as far away from the litter tray as possible. An area for the cat to hide and or sit at a height will enhance welfare. All staff should be trained in the recognition of fear and anxiety behaviours along with appropriate handling of cats. Generally speaking, with cats, less is more. Feline areas of the hospital should be kept quiet and with consideration to avoid bright lighting. Avoid direct eye contact with cats, as this can be perceived as a threatening gesture, and allow the cat to initiate contact. If required, towels or blankets can be used to restrain the cat during examination or procedures. As a last resort, heavy restraint, including the use of crush cages, nets or cat muzzles, may be required to ensure personnel safety, depending upon the cat's temperament. However, these sort of methods are not condoned for routine use, and they should only be used if there's no alternative and only for exceptionally short periods of time, for example, to allow intramuscular injection of sedative drugs in aggressive cats. Moving on to some more of the specifics regarding anaesthesia, one thing that is really important to do is perform a pre-anaesthetic assessment. If a patient is fully assessed prior to their anaesthesia, it allows potential problems to be identified. Use of checklists can ensure that all aspects are addressed in the pre-anaesthetic period, and the Association of Veterinary Anaesthetists, or the AVA, has examples which can be downloaded for free and for use in the practice. After a pre-anaesthetic assessment has been done, a plan can then be formulated to either help prevent such problems from arising, or, if identified problems do occur, appropriate preparation will allow them to be managed effectively. Use of checklists has been shown to reduce post-operative complications both in human medicine and also now in veterinary medicine, so they are worthwhile considering. In some instances, patient temperament may make it impossible to perform a clinical examination and proceed as one would wish. In this case, a best guess approach may have to be performed, taking into account the patient's history, presenting condition, and potential problems which may arise due to their signalment. Ultimately, however, appropriate sedation will have to be administered to ensure personnel safety, even if this carries additional risks to the patient. This should be discussed with the owners so that they are aware of this potential increased risk. In addition to performing a preclinical or pre-anaesthetic examination, knowledge of the idiosyncrasies that feline patients can present can hopefully ensure that we can appropriately manage the cases effectively. Cats' notable differences in terms of natural behaviour, anatomy and physiology, ability to mask underlying disease and their response to treatment requires a feline-specific approach to their anaesthetic management. One big thing to note regarding cats is their ability to metabolise drugs. The majority of administered drugs require metabolism by the liver to allow eventual elimination from the body. This occurs in two phases. We have phase one, which includes but is not limited to oxidation, reduction, and hydrolysis. Such processes primarily convert lipid-soluble agents into more water-soluble compounds, which can be eliminated from the body. The metabolites can either be inactive or active. And then we have phase two, which includes conjugation and glucuronidation, which further increases water solubility and polarity, which enhances renal elimination. As cats are deficient in glucuronyl transferases, they are unable to perform glucuronidation, and this can have an impact on the sort of drugs that we can administer to cats. Many anaesthetic drugs require glucuronidation. However, it is possible that cats can use alternative pathways for metabolizing some of these drugs. For example, morphine can be metabolized by cats through sulfate conjugation rather than glucuronidation. Drugs which are commonly affected by this lack of ability to perform glucuronidation include propofol, carprofen, aspirin, and paracetamol. In some instances, this may just prolong the drug action, while in others, for example, paracetamol, it can result in toxicity and therefore the drug should never be administered. The inability to perform glucuronidation is particularly significant with regard to metabolism of phenolic compounds such as propofol, and this can result in oxidative injury to feline red blood cells. This can cause Heinz body formation, anemia, and more rarely, methemoglobinemia. Studies have shown that a 5 to 7 day consecutive propofol anesthesia in cats can result in clinical illnesses, hematological changes, and prolonged recovery times. Additionally, many drugs, notably propofol, use benzyl alcohol as their preservative, which also requires glucuronidation. Excessive amounts of benzyl alcohol can cause central nervous system toxicity, although the concentration of benzyl alcohol, which is present in licensed preparations of propofol, do not appear to cause clinical problems in healthy cats. Local anesthetic use can be essential to feline anesthesia. For example, topical laryngeal administration during tracheal intubation or use of eutectic mixture of local anesthetic or Emla cream to aid with intravenous cannula placement. However, cats are often considered to be more sensitive to the toxic effects of local anesthetics, which can lead to reluctance to utilize them. While there may be some truth to this, part of the problem is likely to be the small size of the feline patient, which makes the risk of overdose greater. This is particularly true if use of local anesthetic is planned for more than one area. For example, topical laryngeal use combined with a regional anesthetic block for example, hind limb surgery or for dental surgery. Clinicians should be mindful of the total local anesthetic dose being used and be aware of the potential for cumulative toxicity should a mixture of local anesthetics being used. The benefits of local anesthetic use cannot be underestimated, with studies in humans illustrating reduced recovery times, earlier hospital discharge, reduced mortality and morbidity, and increased patient satisfaction. Available local anesthetics with their clinical particulars are illustrated in the table on the slide, but only the only licensed drugs for small animals are lidocaine and procaine, so we must be aware and follow the local rules regarding the cascade with regards to using the other drugs. Intravenous administration of lidocaine is often advocated for analgesia in canine patients, particularly for visceral or neuropathic pain. However, it's not usually recommended to use this technique for feline patients. Studies have shown that thermal antinociception was not affected with intravenous lidocaine, which maybe hints at the fact that its analgesic action in cats may be limited. And when lidocaine was administered concurrently with isoflurane anesthesia, it appeared to be associated with a greater cardiovascular depression than an equipotent dose of isoflurane alone. So therefore, the benefits we may get from MAC sparing with a lidocaine infusion are kind of negated because it causes greater cardiovascular depression. Cats are particularly prone to suffering from nausea and vomiting with some anesthetic agents, notably opioids and alpha-2 agonists. It is more commonly seen when the drug is administered via the subcutaneous or intramuscular route compared to the intravenous route. Meropotent is a very effective antiemetic in cats, although it probably does need to be administered prior to the emetic agent for maximal benefit. While acepromazine has been shown to have antiemetic properties in dogs when administered 15 to 20 minutes prior to an opioid, this hasn't been demonstrated in cats. An important point that I have to mention is the potential risk of post-anaesthetic blindness and deafness in cats, and they are particularly at risk for this. This is especially true when a spring-loaded mouth gag is used, for example during dental or endoscopic procedures. Use of such mouth gags can therefore not be recommended in an effort to try and minimise the potential or the possibility of post-anaesthetic blindness. The particulars of feline anatomy relating to cerebral blood flow are thought to be responsible for this risk of post-anaesthetic blindness and deafness. Although in the newborn kitten, the internal carotid artery is functional, the extracranial portion becomes non-patent within a few weeks of life and plays no role in the adult feline brain's blood supply. Therefore, the majority of the blood supply to the feline brain, retina, and inner ear arises via the maxillary artery, which is a continuation of the external carotid artery. This traverses around the caudal aspect of the mandible, between the medial aspect of the angular process of the mandible and the rostrolateral border of the tympanic bulla, which we can see in the pictures here in pictures B and C. Studies have shown that this space narrows when the mouth is held open, with a subsequent reduction in blood flow. With prolonged mouth opening, such as when a mouth gag is used, the reduced blood flow is worse on the ipsilateral side to the mouth gag. And this is due to, or thought to be due to maxillary artery compression from the surrounding soft tissue. Use of a spring-loaded mouth gag, which results in forced maximal mouth opening, results in more cats suffering cerebral circulatory compromise compared to the submaximal mouth opening achieved through the use of a non-spring-loaded alternative. A needle cap is most commonly used for this purpose. This is evidenced by reduction in ERG, electroretinography, and magnetic resonance angiography signals. However, caution is advised even with the use of a non-spring-loaded gag because although less frequent and with no notable adverse clinical outcome, in these studies, alterations in blood flow were still seen. Smaller non-spring-loaded gags were not associated with any changes in ERG or magnetic resonance angiography and may minimise the risk of reduced maxillary artery blood flow. Therefore, it's probably wise to consider cutting down a needle cap to create a smaller sized, non-spring-loaded mouth gag should one be required for the procedure. I have had some people say that they are worried regarding the use of using a cut-down needle cap as it may result in tooth fracture. However, I think if we can warn the owners of this potential risk. Personally, if it was my cat, I'd much rather have a cat with a tooth fracture than one with post-anaesthetic blindness or deafness. While feline patients are very good at hiding illnesses, they are no less likely to suffer from comorbidities compared to dogs. This may mean that subclinical or undiagnosed diseases may be present, which can still have an impact of anaesthesia. Typical examples include renal and cardiac disease. Renal insufficiency is a common comorbidity, particularly in the older feline patient. Renal insufficiency commonly presents with polydipsia and polyuria. However, this may not be noticed by owners if cats have access to the outdoors. Other clinical signs indicating renal disease and thus the need for further investigation can include anorexia and vomiting. In some cases, it may be that the first hint of renal insufficiency is identified on evaluation of a pre-anaesthetic blood screen with azotemia and electrolyte imbalances. Obviously, hyperkalemia can be associated with acute kidney injury, while chronic cases can present with hypokalemia and hyperphosphatemia. As a non-regenerative anemia is associated with chronic kidney disease, a PCV and TP should also be considered. We should always try and use the International Renal Interest Society, or the IRIS, staging when we are dealing with cases of renal insufficiency. And this can help guide our therapy and hopefully get our patients into the best possible state for the sedation or anaesthetic protocol that they require. In terms of how to prepare our patients ready for anaesthesia, fluid therapy is going to be a key aspect in terms of the preparation. The cardinal clinical signs of renal insufficiency include polyuria and polydipsia, vomiting and anorexia, all of which can contribute to dehydration and associated electrolyte disturbances. Metabolic acidosis may also be a feature of chronic kidney disease. All of these things can benefit from pre-anaesthetic fluid therapy. If a means of accurately delivering fluids, such as an infusion pump, is not available, then care should be taken if cats are admitted for intravenous fluid therapy the night prior to anaesthesia. It's very easy to administer excessive amounts of fluid in unsupervised cats, as the flow is dependent upon patient positioning and movement. If the anaesthetic is scheduled towards the end of the operating list, for example, with dental procedures, a morning admit is feasible and pre-anaesthetic fluids administered at this point. This can then be continued throughout anaesthesia and the recovery period to help optimize renal perfusion and therefore reduce the risk of further renal injury. Renal blood flow and glomerular filtration rate are subject to autoregulation. Between a mean arterial blood pressure of 60 and 150 millimetres of mercury, renal blood flow is constant. However, to mean arterial blood pressure of less than 60 millimetres of mercury, there will be the blood flow becomes dependent upon the blood pressure. Equipment such as a Doppler or non-invasive blood pressure monitoring should be used to monitor blood pressure throughout the anaesthetic period and help maintain the mean arterial blood pressure above 60 millimetres of mercury, or if using a Doppler, a pressure above 80 millimetres of mercury on the Doppler. The other end of the scale, a common feature of chronic kidney disease is hypertension, which results from sodium and water retention by the failing kidneys. Chronic hypertension often causes a shift to the right in the autoregulation curve. In such cases, it is sensible to aim for a higher mean arterial blood pressure under anaesthesia. Severe hypertension may also require treatment with medications such as angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors prior to anaesthesia. Care should be taken with the use of peri-anaesthetic non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs in renal disease patients. Although reduction of prostaglandin production is the underlying reason for their anti-inflammatory action, regulation of renal blood flow is also dependent upon prostaglandins. This may therefore risk further ischemic renal injury, particularly if hypotension or hypovolemia occur during anaesthesia. The use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs is undoubtedly an important aspect of multimodal analgesia. However, it may be prudent to administer these drugs postoperatively or only once it's known that the patient has an adequate mean arterial blood pressure with minimal risk of hemorrhage. Another likely comorbidity that cats suffer from is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM. An HCM is common in cats, with reports of a prevalence of around 15% in apparently healthy cats, with some pure breeds having a higher prevalence. It is important to appreciate that the presence or absence of a heart murmur is not a reliable indicator of heart disease. With HCM, left ventricular hypertrophy leads to diastolic dysfunction. The heart is unable to relax and thus fill properly. This reduces cardiac output, with more severe disease resulting in left atrial dilation and left-sided congestive heart failure. Hypertrophy is not matched by increased coronary perfusion, and myocardial hypoxia contributes to advancing disease and arrhythmogenesis. Heart disease may manifest with pleural effusion instead of, or in addition to, pulmonary edema. Cats with HCM and left atrial dilation are at risk of arterial thromboembolism. In terms of how this can impact our anaesthesia, cats with HCM are at a risk of decompensation if preload is increased, for example by intravenous fluid therapy or sympathetic drive. Therefore, minimizing sympathetic activation is crucial. The patient and its environment should be kept as stress-free as possible. A greater degree of sedation than usual may be considered appropriate for these patients in order to reduce stress. Tachycardia should be avoided as it increases myocardial work and decreases the available time in diastole for ventricular filling. Hypovolemia reduces already compromised ventricular filling and should thus also be avoided. Attempts should be made to minimize outflow tract obstruction to prevent further reduction in stroke volume. Conditions that worsen obstruction include enhanced contractility, decreased ventricular volume, and reduced afterload. So we've already mentioned a little bit about airway management and the potential risks associated with placement of an endotracheal tube in cats. It is normally considered best practice to place an endotracheal tube in all anaesthetized animals. However, the increased risk associated with their use in cats does seem counterintuitive, as we've already said, because an endotracheal tube ensures a protected airway, somewhat negating the risk of obstruction and aspiration. However, cats have a sensitive larynx, they're prone to spasm and edema, and can also result in upper respiratory tract obstruction. They also are at risk of tracheal trauma or tearing from the tracheal trauma or tearing from the endotracheal tube as a result of overinflation of the cuff, excessive cervical and head manipulation, or use of a stylet during placement. Therefore, we have to have take great care when we're moving the anaesthetized patient, particularly with head and neck positioning, to minimize tracheal trauma. Having said this, for most cases, however, it's still often the best choice to place an endotracheal tube, because the benefits of an endotracheal tube placement can often outweigh these risks if we ensure we have careful management of the patient. In terms of the options we have available for airway management, there are quite a few, and this can include the use of a cuffed endotracheal tube, an uncuffed endotracheal tube, a supraglottic airway device, which is most commonly known as the commercially available V-gel, a face mask, or nothing. For relatively rapid elective procedures, for example, a neutering procedure in a healthy cat, which can be performed solely with injectable anaesthesia, it is reasonable to omit placing an endotracheal tube in a cat, given the association with increased mortality and generally the reduced risk of regurgitation that cats have compared with dogs. However, it's recommended that if we opt for omitting an endotracheal tube, that we have equipment ready to perform intubation should the need arise, so that we can do this quickly. As I've said, an alternative to endotracheal intubation is the use of specific supraglottic airway devices, such as the V-gel, which will enable some airway protection but doesn't require passage of the endotracheal tube through the larynx. When it's considered that the benefits of placing an endotracheal tube outweigh the risks, due diligence should be taken with management of the airway. A suitable length and diameter of endotracheal tube should be used. The endotracheal tube should be pre-measured from the level of the incisors to the thoracic inlet, that is the tip of the shoulder, and then cut down to the correct length if required. Longer endotracheal tubes can result in endobronchial intubation and potentially intrathoracic tracheal tears. Most cats require endotracheal tubes of diameter 3.5 millimeters to 5 millimeters, although a wider range, for example 2 to 5.5, should be available if they are needed. Use of an uncuffed endotracheal tube reduces the risk of tracheal damage, but it does not protect from aspiration, and there can be significant leakage of gas around the tube, particularly during positive pressure ventilation. While use of a cuffed endotracheal tube ensures a secure airway and allows effective positive pressure ventilation, overinflation of the cuff can lead to to tracheal damage, including necrosis, stenosis, and tearing, which is what we can see in these pictures here. Now, these pictures have come from an experimental study using dogs, but we can see picture A shows a normal, healthy trachea, and then picture B is where there has been deliberate forced overinflation of the cuff, which has caused pressure necrosis on the tracheal mucosa. Picture C is as this is starting to heal. And then picture D is a couple of weeks later. We can see that there is significant stenosis associated with that trachea as part of the healing process. Multiple ways to assess cuff inflation can be used. The most common include palpation of the pilot balloon or inflation of the cuff until no audible leak is heard upon positive pressure ventilation. And this is known as the minimal occlusive volume technique. However, both of these have been shown to produce inconsistent results, with overinflation being most common. Level of experience does not improve this, and to ensure the recommended cuff inflation pressure of between 19 to 25 millimeters of mercury is not exceeded, it is recommended to use a manometer. There are some reusable semi-disposable devices available for this, and these are known as cuff fills, but alternatively a reusable manometer is possible as well. Care should be taken to ensure an appropriate anesthetic depth prior to tracheal intubation. Use of a laryngoscope will facilitate airway visualization and aid with atraumatic intubation. Topical lidocaine can minimize the likelihood of spasm, although preservative-free solutions should be used. Reports of fatal laryngeal edema have been made when solutions containing preservative are used. And also, excessive doses should be avoided as toxic levels can accumulate. As we've already said, should local anesthetic use be planned as part of a balanced analgesia protocol. Temperature management is really quite important for our feline patients, in part due to their small size. Normally, homeostatic mechanisms closely control body temperature in mammals to ensure optimal metabolism. Anesthetic drugs depress the brain's thermoregulatory center, which along with immobility and reduced metabolic activity can result in hypothermia. External factors also play a role, with clipping, skin preparation solutions and open body cavities increasing heat loss. Body heat in anesthetized animals can be lost through different mechanisms. This can include radiation of infrared waves to the surroundings, which accounts for most heat loss, convection of heat from blood under the skin to the air, conduction to adjacent surfaces such as the operating table, and evaporation of water through open body cavities or the respiratory tract. In the picture here, we can see that there are many simple ways in which we can prevent or minimize patient heat loss. So we can see that there is an HME or a heat moisture exchanger is being used, which reduces heat loss through evaporation from the respiratory tract. The cushion table will reduce heat loss through conduction, while the bubble wrap covering the patient and around the feet will reduce heat loss through radiation and convection. Over the next few slides, we're going to look at some specific ways we can help maintain patient body temperature. The first of which is pre-warming, that is starting to warm the patient before we even sedate them with a pre-medication. In human medicine, it has been shown that pre-warming does minimize hypothermia, while the veterinary evidence is still equivocal. The idea behind pre-warming is that it helps minimize hypothermia through a reduction of heat redistribution from the patient's core to their periphery, and therefore heat loss to the environment is reduced. Clipping removes the patient's natural insulation, and surgical preparation solutions allow further heat loss to be lost through evaporation. While this is necessary to ensure surgical cleanliness, we do need to make sure that we keep both of these to as small an area as possible in order to try and minimize heat loss through these mechanisms. Environmental temperature will determine to what degree heat is lost through radiation and convection, which begins soon after premedication. A higher environment temperature reduces the gradient between patient and room, thus reducing patient heat loss. Reducing air movement, for example, from air conditioning units, can also help minimize heat loss. Intravenous fluids cannot be used to heat patients, as administered fluids can never be warmer than the patient's body temperature. They must always be below 40 degrees centigrade. However, warming intravenous fluids can help reduce the rate of patient heat loss. Inline fluid warmers tend to be more effective than simply heating the fluid bag. Care should be taken not to infuse or lavage body cavities with large volumes of cold solutions, particularly if they're given rapidly, as this can actually cause a rapid decrease in the patient's temperature. Anaesthetized patients are breathing cold, dry gases, which they have to subsequently warm and humidify. Although only a small percentage of body heat is lost via this route, the use of devices such as heat and moisture exchangers, or HMEs, may help minimize this. HMEs work by condensing the moisture from exhaled gas, which will also create a warming effect via latent heat of condensation. On the next inspiration, the cold, dry gas passes over this and becomes humidified and warmed. These can also act as a bacterial and viral filter, depending upon the size of material used in the HME. One study has shown that HMEs to be ineffective in preventing hypothermia when they're used with the rebreathing system in dogs, so that is, for example, a circle system. However, rebreathing systems already have some degree of heat and gas humidification due to their nature, and the effect of the HME might be negated. What we don't know is whether they are effective in non-rebreathing systems, such as, for example, a T-piece, where you would think they would be more effective. We do, however, need to be aware that if we're using HMEs, they will increase the dead space within the breathing system, which can be problematic for, in particular, small patients, neonates, or those with respiratory disease. Insulation of the patient using blankets, bubble wrap, or surgical drapes can reduce the heat loss through radiation, convection, and conduction. Use of material around the extremities can also be beneficial. Passive warming is more effective if instigated after pre-medication rather than waiting until anesthesia is induced. However, all of these methods will only prevent further heat loss and do not warm the patient. On the other hand, the aim of active surface warming is to increase the patient or the temperature immediately surrounding the patient, thus reducing the temperature gradient and patient heat loss. They can include methods such as warm water bottles, circulating warm water or electrical heat pads, or forced air warming blankets. Forced air blankets such as the bear hugger or cocoon are the safest and most effective intraoperative warming technique, although they are also the most expensive. When doing active surface warming, we really need to take extreme care, particularly with things such as heat pads and warmed water or weak bottles, as these can very easily cause patient thermal burns. An insulating layer should always be used between the heat source and the patient, and this is particularly true when during anesthesia, because the patient is unable to move away from the heat source. Active core warming techniques aim to warm the patient's core compared to those which only warm the periphery, but they do tend to be more invasive. It can include using warm fluids to lavage the peritoneum or pleural cavities intraoperatively, or use of a warm water enema or instilling warm saline into the bladder. As before, fluids should not exceed 40 degrees centigrade. Something that we do need to mention in with regards to felines specific anaesthesia is the risk of hypothermia. So the administration of opioid drugs to cats, including morphine, fentanyl, butorphanol, buprenorphine, hydromorphone, and alfentanil, has been shown to cause an increase in patient body temperature. This is thought to be mediated by opioid receptors in the thermoregulatory center of the hypothalamus. Cats have regularly demonstrated absolute body temperatures over 40 degrees centigrade, with extremes of 41.8 degrees centigrade. Post Anesthesia hypothermia following opioid administration has been inversely associated with body temperature at extubation. That is, the colder the patients were at extubation, the warmer the cats were during the postoperative period. Such body temperature increases are transient, lasting up to 5 hours, and should not be considered a reason to withhold opioid analgesia from painful cats. In terms of treatment for such hypothermia, it's generally supportive, including removing any warming devices, active cooling if necessary, and considerations of agents such as azithromycin, which results in mild to moderate vasodilation. Use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs does not appear to be effective in reducing body temperature in these situations. However, anecdotally, small doses of naloxone, somewhere between 1 and 5 micrograms per kilogram IV, can be effective in restoring normothermia. Care is advised, however, given the transient nature of the hypothermia, the resulting difficulties in pain management after naloxone administration may negate its use for this purpose. An important part of anesthesia for any patient is provision of analgesia and recognition of acute pain in the perioperative period. When dealing with non-verbal beings, which includes neonatal humans or all of our veterinary species, it falls to the caregiver to recognize and interpret signs of pain. This requires a basic level of skill and knowledge of the individual species. Although pain results in numerous physiological changes, these are often non-specific to pain, and so we cannot solely rely on such variables in order to identify pain. In clinical practice, pain assessment primarily involves recognition of behavioural alterations, which can include both loss of normal behaviours and development of new behaviours. It's therefore critical that any assessor is aware of the normal behaviour for the specific species. Pain assessment in non-verbal species can be complicated further by external factors. The presence of environmental or situational stressors can modulate the patient's response to pain. Administration of sedative drugs as part of a perianesthetic protocol may mask behavioral changes associated with pain. In humans, the pain response can be amplified by anxiety, causing hyperalgesia, and it is possible that a similar scenario may occur in veterinary species. Observer-specific factors including age, gender, clinical experience, previous personal experience, and time since graduation can also influence the overall pain assessment. Use of pain scales can be very helpful to allow repeatable assessments of pain. Many pain scales are available, but it is important to appreciate that these are not interchangeable. Some of the scales available for pain assessment in cats include the Glasgow Composite Measure Pain Scale, the Boccicacci Multidimensional Composite Pain Scale, and the Colorado State University Simple Descriptive Scale. In terms of analgesia, there are two key concepts which need to be remembered for treating postoperative and acute pain, and that is preemptive analgesia and multimodal analgesia. With regards to preemptive analgesia, it is basically analgesia administered prior to the noxious stimuli, and it is thought that this reduces the subsequent pain experience and makes it easier to manage. Preemptive analgesia will reduce the initiation and maintenance of peripheral and central sensitization. However, it's important to appreciate that for continued efficacy, analgesia needs to be maintained throughout the period of expected post-operative pain and inflammation, otherwise sensitization may still occur. In some instances, it can be impossible to provide true preemptive analgesia, as the tissue injury may have already occurred, for example, a patient presented for a road traffic accident. In some instances, it is advised to simply start analgesia provision as soon as practically possible in order to minimize the extent to which sensitization may occur. With regards to multimodal analgesia, there are multiple areas where nociceptive transmission or pain perception can be modified. It is generally accepted that using a combination of analgesia methods, thus affecting multiple sites along the pain pathway, will lead to a more effective analgesia quality. Additionally, using complementary or synergistically acting drugs will allow the absolute dose of any individual drug to be reduced. This can minimize potential adverse effects of singular drugs. Now, apologies here for the dog picture, but it does highlight quite well the fact that there are many classes of analgesic agents available for use, and the use of these multiple classes can be beneficial. However, having said that, the prescriber does need to be aware of local licensing regulations, and when we're in the UK, we need to ensure that we follow the VMD's prescribing cascade with regards to the drug use. Drug classes which are considered for treatment of acute and perioperative pain in feline patients often include use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, opioids, local anesthetics, alpha-2 agonists, and NMDA antagonists. It's also important to remember that simple non-pharmacological methods in the immediate postoperative period can significantly improve a patient's comfort and shouldn't be forgotten. They can include the use of good quality nursing care, so ensuring a warm, comfortable environment, allowing ample opportunity for patients to pass urine and feces, and gentle physiotherapy if appropriate. If a patient has a fracture, support of these unstable fractures can provide a degree of instantaneous pain relief and also reduce risk of further tissue damage and inflammation. And then things such as the use of cryotherapy in the postoperative period can help reduce bleeding, inflammation, and pain. So to conclude, cats can be more challenging to manage when compared with dogs, particularly in the peri-anesthetic period. But if we have a knowledge of the feline idiosyncrasies, we can help improve anesthetic and analgesic management, which will hopefully improve both patient and clinician experience when we're dealing with these patients. So if anybody has any questions, we have one here. I'll see if I can read it out to you all. Apologies, just trying to make it a little bit bigger so I can see. Thank you. If the question is, if you use gabapentin for an aggressive patient, how would you adapt the pre-medication before a procedure? So that's a very good question. And I think to some extent, it depends upon how the gabapentin has affected the patient. So if the patient is relatively sedated, then what I would probably do would be simply just to reduce my doses of drugs slightly. In terms of drug choices, the use of gabapentin doesn't really affect my drug choices as such. So I would still use the drugs which I would have done had the patient not had gabapentin. It simply comes down really to drug doses. So if they are very sedated, I will probably just reduce the doses slightly. If they don't really look like they're sedated at all, then I would probably just use similar doses to previously. I hope that answers the question for you.
Brilliant. Thanks very much for that, Becky. On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Becky for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.